The Bible study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary. Yes, indeed, it is your turn. Phones are open to you at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Ask the Pastor, and we have with us Dr. Martin Noland. Good morning.
Morning.
I don't have my cue sheet here. Where are you located these days?
Oh, I'm in Evansville, Indiana, which is the southwestern toe of the state of Indiana.
Mm-hmm. And your church is?
Trinity Lutheran Church. We're the oldest, we're the mother church for the Missouri Synod Lutherans around here.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And especially today, give us a call if you have a question about church history, because Dr. Martin Noland, he's the go-to guy for that kind of thing. Dr. Noland, I noticed that today we recognize Cyril of Alexandria. Is this a saint?
Well, I think that he is considered a saint. Let's check here. Yeah, he is in the list of saints of the Roman Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
and he is was declared a doctor of the church by Pope Leo in 1882. He goes way back into early Christian history. He is a contemporary of Constantine. He is one of the first bishops, or actually a patriarch, which is higher than an archbishop, if you can imagine. Mm. The Pope is kind of like the patriarch of the West. And St. Cyril was the patriarch of Alexandria, would make him like the Pope of Africa, basically. And at the time, there was not a division of the Christian church, the East, which would have been Jerusalem and Antioch, and the north in Greece, and the west in Rome, and the south in Alexandria were all working together. They recognized each other. They were in fellowship, quite unlike the way things are today. And but anyway, he was at this very prominent position. And he is known for really two things. First off, he is the one that finally defines what we call Christology. That is, how can Jesus be both God and man?
So the two natures of Christ.
Right, the two natures of Christ. And there's discussions of that in for the Lutherans. You can go to your Lutheran Book of Concord, and you can see in the index there are several references in the Book of Concord to Cyril, and he is quoted in a positive way as establishing certain doctrines of the faith.
Ah, so he contributed to the theology that we believe and understand today in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod?
That is correct. Mm. And as well as the doctrine that is professed by the Roman Catholic Church, and I believe also there wasn't a division at the time, so you would, his theology of the doctrine of Christ is shared by the Roman Catholics, by the Eastern Orthodox churches, and by the Lutherans that uphold the traditional creeds and confessions of the church.
Now, I did a little digging, and here he is a saint, but he became most notorious from his controversy with Nestorius, Patriarch of Constantinople. Nestorius refused to give to Mary the predicate? And then there's a Greek word I can't pronounce.
Theotokos.
There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you. This occasioned Cyril to write a treatise explaining the union of the Logos and the human nature in Christ and the birth of Logos by Mary, and to issue an encyclic letter to the Egyptian monks warning them against Nestorianism. What is that?
Well, Nestorianism is a considered a heresy, and it did divide the early church. And this controversy was in a thing in which Cyril played a strong leadership role. And it continues today in some of the far eastern churches. There are, with all the conflict that goes in the Middle East, it's hard to believe that there are any Christians left. But there is a Syrian church, and there's actually two of them. One of them is in fellowship and agrees with the doctrine on this issue of Christology,
mm-hmm.
with Rome and the Greek churches and with Lutherans. That's known as the Syrian Orthodox Church. And then there is the Nestorian Church, which in this controversy at the time of St. Cyril, they held the Nestorian view, and they've never given it up. So in most respects, you consider them Christian. In fact, compared to some sects and cults today, you have to say they are Christian. And they were also these Nestorian Christians were very energetic in missions, and they were successful in propagating the faith to India and to China early, like in the 5th or 6th century. So they're a very significant church, but not well known among us today. So this controversy happens about 430 A.D. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the Patriarch of Constantinople. So let's imagine, using today's terms, you have in 430 you have a pope in Rome. They didn't call them that; they call them patriarchs. But you had a pope in Rome, you had a pope in Alexandria, Egypt, who is Cyril, and you had a pope in Constantinople, who is Nestorius. And then there's also one in Antioch. And Nestorius supports one of his military chaplains, who says that we shouldn't call the Virgin Mary by the name the God-bearer, or the idea that she was perhaps the mother of God, because that lends the idea that, well, whoever is the mother is higher than the child.
I see, yeah.
And you can see why they would have this concern. If you look at Roman Catholic imagery today, much of the imagery where Jesus and Mary are together is Mary is the recent mother and Jesus is a baby. Mm-hmm. Well, who's the superior and who's the inferior?
Right.
And this, I think, was the original concern. However, Nestorius went too far in not understanding that Jesus, when he was born, really was God. You just can't deny that. And this is what Cyril said, no, we can't give up that. If people are confused, it's their own problem. But Jesus, when he was born of a divine father, and so he was God in the womb and when he was born, even if it doesn't make sense to human eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few other things that he contributed was the establishment of certain terminology to make sure that people didn't confuse. So one thing he would say was that you don't confuse the two natures of Christ. Jesus is both God and man. It's not as if there's a new substance put together. Like when you put ions together in chemistry, sodium ions and chlorine ions, which are two separate, you put them together and you make a new thing called salt, sodium chloride. Well, that's not what happened here. The two natures retain their distinct attributes. And so the whole technology, say, of talking about Jesus and how the divine and human natures work together, that comes to us from St. Cyril.
Mm. Now, St. Cyril was also a sinner.
Yeah.
It says here that he expelled the Novatians from their church and robbed their church treasury. He led in person the mob which drove all the Jews away from Alexandria in 415, and he took part, at least indirectly, in the foul murder of Hypatia.
Yeah, he wasn't necessarily the easiest guy to get along with. You have to understand that. So, yeah, you have to understand that some of our saints, I mean, he is recognized as a saint by the Roman Church, often have problems. And now, I think in the case of these things, you have to understand that it is his responsibility as the head of the church to keep the church on the true way. And the Novatians, the Neoplatonists, and the Jews, when they are making inroads in the church itself, it's his responsibility to say, hey, you can't teach that. But the problem exists is that the empire is already beginning to become Christian. And so not only is the church supposed to be Orthodox, but now the state is. And so you begin here, at the time of St. Cyril to see the problem that those that are really Orthodox Christians, and they believe what Jesus says, but now they're confronted by people that do not want to become Christians. But the emperor says, you shall become Christian. And then the emperor expects that the patriarch or the archbishops are supposed to enforce that. And the emperor depends on the archbishop to tell him who are the people that are not Orthodox and who should be prosecuted because they don't want to be Christian. Constantine says, I want to be Christian, and I want all my people to be Christian. And if they don't want to be, I need to know who those are. So then the higher-ups in the church, such as St. Cyril, have this responsibility for identifying the heretics, and that's why they get this bad name. It's a mixture, in our view, of church and state, but that's how it was under Constantine.
Not a theocracy, though.
Well, not exactly. No, the theocracy really develops in the West under the Bishop of Rome, who later became the Pope, but it is a much more closer attachment of church and state than we would be comfortable. And the fact that to be a citizen of the Roman Empire at this time, you would have to profess Christianity.
So there was always a lot of tension, I suppose, from the beginning in the church, to keep it on the straight and narrow, to keep things orthodox, to keep things the way they were meant to be.
Well, yeah, it's more of an attachment to Jesus first, and then secondly to what he taught. Because, I mean, although there are some Christian churches around the world that venerate and genuflect before the Bible, which is, you know, that's the deposit. That's what we have today of Jesus, besides the sacraments, but chiefly the Bible. What we worship is Jesus himself. So the feelings and the attachments and the loyalties are all to Jesus. But then secondarily, then also to his word. And if people are going around and saying, this is what Jesus said, when it isn't what he said, there's going to be problems. That's just the way it's going to be.
Now, the last pope, and his name escapes me now, I'm sorry, the pope before the pope...
John Paul II, you mean?
Yes. He believed that Mary was a co-redemptress, I believe. And when did Mary begin to emerge in the church on an equal footing with God and Jesus? When did that start?
Well, I wouldn't say that she is... first off, this is not actually... happening. I mean, that from our perspective as Protestants,
absolutely,
she is just a saint.
No, but within the Roman Catholic Church.
Within the Roman Church, yeah. This is a long process. It doesn't happen overnight. And I think, I do think that this controversy at the time of Cyril tells us that something was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Cyril was correct to uphold the doctrine of Christ as he did. But I think Nestorius was looking at people around Cyril and those like him and said, you know, you're really giving too much credence to the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Uh-huh.
It's going too far. She is a saint like Matthew and Mark and St. Paul, and she's one of those. But she doesn't have a special, even higher rank just because she happened to bear Jesus. Mm-hmm. She was one of the people at the time of Jesus that, you know, supported him, cared for him, Joseph too. You know what? Here's a good question to ask your Roman Catholic friends. If Mary is so high in elevation, why isn't Joseph? Because traditionally among the saints, Joseph, I believe, is called the protector of Jesus. Well, I mean, that's... when a mother gives birth to a child, she protects him and feeds him and does all the things that children need. You know, Joseph should actually be the Holy Family, not just the Virgin Mary. So, yeah, you've got a good question there of why did Mary come to be the saint above all saints, almost higher than Jesus, at least in the sense of piety and who people feel an affection for. So, that's a really good question.
So Mary became a distraction away from Jesus at some point in history, church history.
Yeah.
And then people started praying to saints.
Right.
Did this begin with Mary, and then it was like a slippery slope, and pretty soon...
Yeah, and my research on this, and there's not a lot that you would find this in the regular textbooks. My doctoral work was in church history, and my doctoral advisors and teachers, they wanted me to have a broad reading in all of history, so I just read everywhere during 4 years of doctoral work.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is out of the textbooks. It's into the specialists, into the scholars, and even recent scholarship of the last couple of decades. And there has been some interest in the history of, I've talked about this on the radio before, maybe a couple of years ago,
mm-hmm.
the what's known as the Cluny Reform. It's a group of monasteries in France in the area of Burgundy. You know, this wine we call Burgundy comes from that area. And it's great wine, by the way. It was viticultured for centuries until they got it just right. But anyway, the Cluny Reform happens in about the 9th and 10th century. And it's a reform of monasticism. And it's partly, it's very... it's autocratic. The guy that's the head of the Cluny Monastery rules with an iron fist. There's no collegiality, and that's a big difference from the whole church before that. Or certainly for the monasteries. The monasteries always treated each other as brothers. There is this this whole thing that happens with liturgy, so that the monasteries at Cluny spend all their day, except for eating and sleeping, they spend all their day in worship, which has never been done before. That's a new thing.
Hmm.
And then the other thing is interesting is to look at the what are they doing in liturgy? And they begin to develop some new festivals, what we call All Souls Festival. The doctrine of purgatory apparently really takes hold in an institutional way in the Cluny monasteries, as they celebrate the Festival of All Souls, which is about the same time as we celebrate Halloween. And what it is their way of saying, we as monks can take your family members, who we know were bad sinners, and we can help get them out of that area of purgation and up into heaven. And so then the question is, who are the people that can do this? Because that isn't a Jesus theology at all. So then the idea then develops that the saints, who have meritorious and extra works, are able to help. So the monasteries, in connection with the saints, then begin to develop this whole theology of purgatory, and that the people that have died can go to heaven after a certain amount of works have been done. And the way that works then is that you pay the monastery your offering, and they'll pray for your family member, and after doing this long enough, eventually they'll get there. So really, as far as scholars can tell, this sort of unusual devotion to Mary and praying to the saints and actually putting them in the doctrine of salvation begins to happen in Cluny. And after Cluny takes over, which it does with Hildebrand, and I believe that's the 11th century, it takes over the whole Roman Catholic Church, then their theology penetrates everywhere in the West.
And Dr. Nolan, I always wonder if there's Jesuits out there, highly educated theological masters, that realize that a lot of this church tradition is unfounded. There's nothing in the Bible that points to this kind of behavior or belief system, but I guess they just can't stop it.
Yeah, the Roman Catholic Church today, especially in the United States, the scholars are diverse in their belief and practice, and for the hierarchy in Rome, it's disconcerting. They don't know exactly what to do about it. America is generally much more liberal than almost any of the other countries that are under Roman Catholic influence. And our colleges and universities that are Catholic in particular, they're always complaining about them. So you have some Roman Catholic professors that even just deny the faith altogether, and they have been put on the heretics list and banished from the church. I believe, I don't want to make a judgment that's not there, but I know that Dominic Crossan was under judgment. I don't know if he has officially been banned from the church. I know Hans Kung in University of Tübingen was, that did happen to him for sure. So there are some that are, I mean, they just don't really believe anything that's in the Bible is even true, or that much of it is. You know, they're full-blown higher critics. But there are many others in the Roman Church who accept the Bible as coming from the apostles and prophets. But yes, they do know that a lot of this tradition is, it can't be supported. It can't be supported as certainly the teaching of Jesus and the apostolic church. But they're in a position of saying, well, we really don't want to offend the faithful, partly because they help support our universities, so we don't want to make that too loud of a statement. So, but they do know that. The better educated Roman Catholic University scholars do know these things that I've been telling you. In fact, you know, a lot of Protestant scholars are learning these things from both French and Roman Catholic scholars in the United States.
Pastor Lukomsky told me there is no Saint Christopher. There was no person like that.
That's true. There's no historical person at all. That's a pure legend, which, you know, it may upset a few Roman Catholic people, but even I think a lot of Roman Catholic people know that was a legend, a pious legend. It teaches even Luther quotes. I was just reading the other day, Luther quoting about St. Christopher is an example of a Christian that has to bear a difficult burden, or what Luther calls a cross. And Christopher puts the child on his shoulder, starts across the stream, and the child's not so heavy when he's on the bank, but once he gets in the middle of the water, they're both ready to go under. And he uses that, I think, as Roman Catholics did, as a indication of how the burdens of life can be difficult. And at first, they don't seem so bad, but then as you get on, they can be bad. So even Luther uses the figure of St. Christopher, but I think most Roman Catholics that have been to college today, they would know that he is a legendary figure.
And you see these billboards for Our Lady of Guadalupe, perhaps. We have them in St. Louis from time to time. That's another legend. That's a legend. And when I see those billboards, it seems to me that it's just a big distraction. It's not pointing to Jesus. It's pointing away from him.
Yeah, now that would be a little more difficult to deal with than, let's say, St. Christopher, because I think the legend of St. Christopher, I don't know exactly what when that first showed up, but I think most Roman Catholics would say, yeah, he really was, well, it says he was 251, so that's before the time of Cyril. So there are some people that would say that he was, it says he was an ugly giant. Well, now that kind of makes it in the legendary case. But we'll talk about Guadalupe after the break.
Oh, good. Good for you. You hear the tone.
Yeah, I know. That's a cue, right?
You're very good. Dr. Martin Noland, taking your calls today at 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. It's Ask the Pastor on the Bible study, and we've got a historian with us today, Dr. Martin Noland.
Concordia Seminary has four core values, and one core value is excellence. People today demand the very best. Even people who ignore or misrepresent God's word of truth often strive for excellence. So shouldn't we strive all the more for excellence in our churches and seminary? Pastoral leaders will hold excellence high, helping invite people to the truth of our message.
AMA 50 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AM 850 KFUO underwriter.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Canadian teens are walking across their country to bring attention to unborn babies killed by abortion. They're called Crossroads. The kids are sore, have blisters, and two blown out knees, and they've attracted Satan's attention. The RV constantly needs small repairs, and the support vehicle was totaled by another driver while going to speak at a church. Last year, the same thing happened. But a young girl was at that church, heard their message, and changed her mind about having an abortion. Maybe the devil was trying to avoid another save this year. These youthful heroes walk 5 days a week and spend weekends praying in front of abortion mills and speaking at churches. Find out how you can help them save lives. Visit today's broadcast link at lifeissues.org.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
After the flood, I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. Evangelical Lutheran Bishop Mark Narum says he spent Sunday visiting churches in his flooded North Dakota diocese. Narum says he assured evacuees around Minot that it was okay to cry out to God in despair and
to be surrounded by faithful people who are praying for them and who are promising to continue to walk with them.
Some New York clergy have started booking gay weddings, while others who opposed legalization now hope to be protected by religious exemptions in the new law. There was celebration at Sunday's Gay Pride Parade in New York from participants like Kyme Levitt.
As a gay Jew, I'm so proud of New York. I grew up here, I grew up as an Orthodox Jew, and we're all so proud to be here, to be who we are.
Under the law, New York state government cannot penalize churches or other religious nonprofits that refuse to make their facilities available for same-sex marriages. I'm Steve Coleman.
I'm in almost every school bus and classroom. I go to school with your children. We say the Pledge of Allegiance together. You've seen me around the neighborhood, and you've told me I'm a pretty good kid. Well, I'm one out of every four children in America, and I'm struggling with hunger. This problem is closer than you think. My teacher tells me we could grow up and be whatever we want. I want to grow up and be someone who doesn't go to bed hungry. There's enough food in this country to feed everyone. Please visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help. Every dollar you donate helps provide 7 meals for kids like me, quietly struggling with hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
It's Ask the Pastor on the Bible Study. Dr. Martin Noland is our guest. And the phones are open at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Perhaps, Dr. Noland, before we move into talking about Our Lady of Guadalupe, we should pick up on a point you made. Herman, I think, wants to follow up on something he heard this morning. Herman, you're on KFUO Radio with Dr. Martin Noland.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask Dr. Noland, you mentioned earlier the Cluny Monastery movement developed the doctrine of purgatory that began to permeate the Western Church. It certainly was there at the time of Martin Luther. That was one of his main issues he addressed. What time frame would you address or say that this started in the Cluny movement in European church history? When would you say is about the first visible date of the generation of this?
That's a good question, Herman. The Order of Cluny, the first monastery was founded, by William the Pious in 909. So that's the beginning of the 10th century. It says the real founder of Cluny's influence was Brno's successor, Saint Odo. That's O-D-O, 927 to 942. Now, I'm not sure I can call for my... There's a couple of books that I've read that are by scholars translated from the French and other languages, but I believe that this monastery, in its under these first two leaders, so that would be in the 10th century, that the innovations in liturgy and the high piety and reverence and veneration that they gave to the saints, and especially to Mary, happened in that period. And then the propagation of the ideas and the expansion of Cluny happened later. And I think I just remembered one fact about that. It helped because Cluny was adopted by the Pope as his favorite monastic group as a way of reforming the church. And from there, once you get the Pope's approval and his support financially helps too, then you're going all over the place. And the final thing when it really took over was as I called Hildebrandt. That would be Pope Gregory the VII. Most historians talk about the role of the repression of simony and the celibacy of clergy under Gregory the VII. But all the things that were invented in Cluny, or at least you might say they really weren't invented. It was more like they were honed and brought to a higher degree of sophistication, especially in regard to these doctrines. That happened under Gregory the VII, and it became dominant after that. And the other way to look at this, to see the evidence of it, is to see when a Romanesque cathedral or church was either torn down or retrofitted so that the original artwork, which displayed Jesus at the altar or above the altar, was replaced with an icon or image or stained glass of Mary. And that begins happening at the time of Gregory, which is, again, about the 11th century. And thereafter, the Gothic movement in architecture always has Mary as front and center and the main person that's the focus of faith.
Oh, thank you very much. So essentially, it starts to percolate with the formation of the Cluny Order, and then when the Pope Gregory comes in the 11th century, it's now getting its leverage to spread through that office throughout the Western Church.
That's correct. And here I have the dates for Gregory. He's Pope from 1073 to 1085, so that's the latter part of the 11th century.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Nolan.
Thank you.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Noland, do we know anything about Martin Luther and the Rosary? If he was Roman Catholic, do you think he said the Rosary? And did he ever write anything about the Rosary? Did he ever publish anything about his thinking on the Rosary?
Good question. I'm going to double check, but I think that the Rosary, in the form that we know it today, is a later development.
Well, what I'm looking at here says the rosary gained greater popularity in the 1500s,
right,
when Muslim Turks were ravaging Eastern Europe.
Right. And so, for something to be, the Roman Catholic Church always makes changes slowly. Uh-huh. You know, people today complain about it, but they just have to look, that's the way it is. And I think, really, there's a lot to be commended for that, because otherwise you're just like you're being blown in the wind, as I think one of the apostles said. But it says that the a tradition current since the 15th century was founded by Saint Dominic in the course of his missionary work against the Albigensians, but in fact seems to develop gradually, especially under Cistercian and Dominican influence. So it seems that it started perhaps in southern France in around the 15th century. Well, Luther is in the 16th century in northern Germany and is really culturally removed from that.
I see.
So I don't think he may have heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he actually saw it, I'm not sure. It says here, here's another thing, the anniversary of the Turks, let's see, it's kept on October 7th, the anniversary of the victory of the Christian naval forces over the Turks of Lepanto. So that evidently is the Rosary's festival in the church. So somehow it's connected with the Battle of Lepanto in 1571.
Our Lady of Guadalupe, those billboards bother me because that has nothing to do with Jesus.
Yeah, it's now, what you would have to say, now the Lady of Guadalupe is a vision that was seen by a Mexican peasant, And so it certainly means a lot to Mexicans in the United States. It's not, I don't think it's universally accepted by all of the Latin Americans, but certainly by the Mexicans. And so we know who this gentleman was. And his vision was tested by the priests. You know, they asked him questions, a whole bank of, you know, they had this procedure for making sure that visions or healings were really, really what they were and weren't false. And he evidently passed the tests. Now, whether he knew how to work the system or whatever you want to say, or maybe he just convinced his judges, but we know who this was, and he was the peasant that saw the vision was a real historical figure. So whether or not he actually saw this, or whether he was confused or something else, that's another judgment. But the vision of the lady and her speaking, I believe she spoke to him too, that is something that is has a historical date, and the Roman Catholics can point to that, as do some of the other visions that have happened in the last couple of centuries.
But from a theological point of view, what's the purpose? God's not behind this, is he? That didn't really happen, did it?
Well, we would not believe that as Protestants. We would believe, for example, Paul warns us about angels who, or demons who dress as angels.
Mm-hmm.
So they were definitely forewarned of anything like that that would happen in our own life. I mean, I've never had a mystical or visionary experience of anything. You know, I've just had a normal, dull life. I don't know about you, Paul. Have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't.
So, you know, I think we have to, as Protestants, we certainly take it with a grain of salt, anything that we see that's after the time of the apostles. We know Jesus. We believe Jesus was God. Jesus was able to do anything. And he gave certain powers to his apostles. And they were able to heal and raise from the dead and do all sorts of things. But after that, after the death of John, all these miraculous things just die out. That they're not reported by anything that's reliable in the early church. And they have not really come since. Luther had to deal with people like this. And they eventually became known as Anabaptists. Not all Anabaptists saw visions, but many of them did, or they claimed to have. And so Luther had to deal with these people, and there is many statements in the Luther Confessions that say Lutherans do not believe this, that if that God does not work apart from the Word and the sacraments today, and that if he did, there would have to be a lot more evidence than what's normally there. And the one of the arguments that I often use with Pentecostals who believe in prophecies and stuff like this, they say, well, are you willing to go under the rules that God has given for prophecy and visions and things like that, that is found in the book of Deuteronomy? And that is that your vision and prophecy has to be tested. You have to be tested. And you have to make a prophecy and be tested against it. And if you're wrong, we get to stone you to death. Now, I've never seen a Pentecostal that would agree to that. But that's the way it worked in the Old Testament. And they actually did kill false prophets. Not all of them, because, you know, eventually the true prophets were complaining about that. So there, in the Old Testament, there is criteria. You don't just let anybody come up and say, oh, I saw a vision, and you believe that that's true. You say, well, maybe you are a prophet, but now we're going to put you on a probationary period. And we want to see, you know, see if this really holds up. And that's kind of what the religious leaders at Jesus' time were doing to him. But they didn't like him because he wouldn't accept their leadership. That's really the problem there. But he passed the test, and he certainly passed the test of God's vindicating Jesus by his resurrection. But you don't have that sort of people willing that are visionaries that are willing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not willing to stand up to that sort of criteria and probation today. They don't pass the test. Then you have to ask the question, well, how did this get through the Roman Catholic order. Well, the Roman Catholics, they need to have visions in order to make this is my own opinion. They need to have some sort of vision or something that happens in countries that are not originally Roman Catholic countries in order to draw them closer to them. So it's kind of like a mark. It's like when the United States put a flag on the moon. What good is that? Yeah, but it's an American flag that's there. Think about it. Mm-hmm. And so when the Blessed Virgin, who is not recognized by any of the Mayan or Aztec deities, I mean, that doesn't show up at all. When the Blessed Virgin Mary shows up to a Mexican peasant, and he's of the Indian type, you know, he's not of the Spanish blood, he's of the Native American in Mexico, well, then that says that God and all the saints through the Roman Catholic Church wants to be in Latin America too. And that's what that means. So when you see the billboards, what that is a message from the Roman Catholic Churches that we want Latin America to be part of us, and God wants you to be part of it too. And I think from that standpoint, that's a good message. It's just that we don't believe as Lutherans that there was actually a vision there.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before we take the next call, just clarify one thing for me. If you pray to Mary or any of the saints or Aunt Hilda, dead people don't hear your prayers, do they?
No, they don't hear your prayers. So it's just wasted time. It's beaten in the air.
All right. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Brian, you're on KFUO with Dr. Martin Noland.
You touched on something that I wanted to ask about. In the book of Leviticus, there are lots of capital crimes that are listed. I was wondering, what evidence do we have, historical evidence, that those sentences were carried out in the way that they were explained in the book of Deuteronomy, or was it that God was giving them kind of a benchmark or a borderline, and that for some things they did carry it out, as you said, with stonings of people who were false prophets. But I never really understand how many of those things were actually carried out the way they were prescribed.
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually, because the historical writings that we have in the Bible are also religious writings, and as they're not... they're not in the type of... They're more like church history, if that makes any sense. So when we write church history, we're really interested in, well, what's happening to the church. We also, when we write history, we might say something that's happening in the society of the day. But we're not going to go into a lot of details about, well, what's going on in the courts, you know, or the prisons, or how poor are people, and because, you know, the poor are there. So when you write church history, you kind of assume that the laws are being, that they're followed, that there are judges that execute them, and that more or less they're being kept, unless there's, you know, a great outcry and a controversy. So, for example, in the United States, we had the Civil War, which is a issue over the laws of slavery. And the North people said, the laws of slavery are immoral and against God, and we will steal your slaves. And the Southerners said, this is not immoral, it's in the Constitution, and we have state rights, and we will keep our slaves, and we'll shoot you if you come to try to get ours. And that starts the Civil War. So that is actually where you see a law is contested and finally falls. And or the actual practice of how law was implemented, because there is no law against the slavery in the Constitution originally. That comes in later. So I would say my judgment is that except where you see the prophets complaining about failure to obey the laws, in other cases that they were actually being done. And I think that when we see at the time of Jesus, our general impression of the Jews at the time of Jesus is they're not all that greatly pious and good people, but they are keeping the laws, and they want to put Jesus to death because he claims to be a prophet, and they think he's a false prophet. Mm-hmm. So they're still carrying that out at the time of Jesus, and that's 2,000 years after Abraham and 1,500 years after Moses.
505-7850-1-800-730-2727. You mentioned the theory on purgatory by the Roman Catholic Church. What do we know from Martin Luther about his views on purgatory?
Well, I think I'd have to go back and check on some of that. He does not believe that there is a place called purgatory, certainly that.
Mm-hmm.
There is no biblical evidence for it at all. I mean, that comes from pagan ideas.
Do they still recognize that today? Because I know they threw out limbo. That's
right.
Where unbaptized babies were said to go.
Right.
That went out in, I think, 2007.
Yeah. As far as I know, at the last edition of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which I have, which dates about 1990 or so,
mm-hmm.
the doctrine of purgatory is still affirmed. They would have to revise a whole lot of their liturgical and other practices to get rid of purgatory, because it's all built into a whole bunch of the different things that they do. There would be a lot bigger discussion. I mean, I would know by now. You know, been a lot of controversies by traditional Catholics saying, oh, you can't get rid of this. Luther said there are passages that talk about the purgation of sin. And some of the earliest church fathers, the Orthodox ones, talked about this. So what does this mean? Does this mean when you die that you're, you know, go through a period of pain and then you're in heaven? Or, you know, so Luther recognizes that there is some problem there. His answer to that is that he believes that what he calls the Holy Cross, that is sufferings that Christians endure in this life because they are faithful to Jesus, that that in fact is whatever the Bible verses talk about as this sort of cleansing or purgation. And it's not meritorious. It doesn't earn you salvation, but it's something that you have to endure, and it burns. You know, it's painful. So that's how Luther interprets that, and he certainly does not believe in a place called purgatory or any of the theology that goes with it.
Hmm. One final issue here before we run out of time. I mentioned this earlier with another pastor. Washington National Cathedral has hosted an interfaith service that featured readings from the Quran, the Torah, and the Gospels. At Sunday's service, Muslim Imam Muhammad Majid said the same God revealed the Torah to Moses, the Gospel to Jesus, and the Quran to Muhammad. The cathedral's Episcopal Dean, the Reverend Samuel Lloyd, said Christianity, Islam, and Judaism are all part of the rich diversity that God has envisioned for our world. I don't think you'd see it that way.
Well, no. And since the time of Jesus, the Christian churches acknowledge that the Old Testament was revealed by the same God that that Jesus recognized as his Father. So the Bible, or the New Testament and the Old Testament, are from the same God. There's no doubt about that. To say that the Quran is from the same God is to jump beyond what Christians have ever affirmed. And, of course, it's a political statement that people are making for whatever political values or uses they want to make, but you would have to accept Islam in totality to accept that statement, because Islam says that it is the final revelation from God and that it embraces and includes all the others. So whoever these gentlemen are that said these three revelations are all cohesive, they really have become Islamic already, which is an irony. Christianity says that Jesus is the final revelation. He is the Messiah that was expected in the Old Testament, and we aren't to expect any more revelation until Jesus comes again.
Let's take this call. James, you're on KFUO Radio with Dr. Martin Noland.
Pastor, as a Christian in culture, is it proper to have a worldview of secular appreciation and use our critical thinking to focus serious attention on the inequalities in our current budget matters? You know, those where they're taking away from the poor and giving to the rich in regards to this big thing about the budget. Is it, as a Christian in culture, is it proper to have a secular, a worldview that has a secular appreciation where you can use your critical thinking to focus serious attention on those inequalities as a Christian? Now hang up and listen.
Thank you, James. No, and I think that's a very good question, and it has to do with any number of political issues. And Christians will disagree, by definition, on political issues. There are actually very few issues that cross what we would call political issues or current issues today that actually that Christianity would actually have something definitive to say. Usually, it's a matter of, as James said, using your critical thinking in the secular arena and trying to come up with something that is right. Now, the big problem is that most people will only vote and to think about what's their own interests. But I think as Christians, we also need to think about our neighbor and all of our neighbors. And the Old Testament is a good example of that, of how it cares for the sojourners and the poor and the laws that do that. So we shouldn't always be thinking about just our own interests, but also those of others, and that is certainly a Christian view. And I would say one person that I have admiration for is Daniel Patrick Monahan, who has looked at one area of society through most of his career. I don't know if he may be deceased at this point. I don't know if he's still practicing. But one area of society throughout his career, and he has tried to understand it, not just as a politician and saying things that get him votes, but try to understand it and do things that improve this area. That I consider, whether or not he is a Christian, and I think he was, that is a Christian way to do things, to take your office seriously as trying to look at after the welfare of those, especially those who are disadvantaged.
We have a minute left. Pastor Nabil Noor, you're on KFUO Radio with Dr. Martin Noland.
Good morning, Dr. Martin. This is Pastor Noor. I just listened about what you made the comment about the teachings of the Quran. That is such a fallacy, and they want to make the Quran on the same equal par as the scriptures are, both Old and New Testament. There's one verse that takes all of their teachings and does away with it, and that's John chapter 14, verse 6. I know we are limited for time, but just want to share. And so John 14, 6 says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes unto the Father except through me. And to add the Quran to that same equal principle of golden nugget truth, we would do away with everything that the cross stands for, because they deny it. They deny the truth and the inerrancy of the, you know, the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross.
They deny the crucifixion, yes.
They deny everything that stands for Christianity, and it's all work righteous versus cross righteousness.
All right. Pastor Nabil Noor, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And Dr. Martin Noland, thank you for a great hour.
Okay.
We appreciate you.
Blessed St. Cyril Day.
Thank you. Listen Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.
Hi, this is Roland Lettner. I'm the host of Studio A on KFUO Radio, heard Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. The program is all about where Christ crosses culture. Christians are not one-dimensional people. Our Christian worldview influences everything we contact, whether it's family or sports, politics, issues like abortion or new definitions of marriage. It's all about being salt and light. That's the Studio A program, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m., hosted by me, Roland Lettner, on KFUO Radio.